morning. Good morning. This is Joanne Bowman.
And this is Dave Mazza.
And you're listening to Voices from the Edge. We're going to have a very, very, very interesting program today, so you probably don't want to be turning your radio dial. We have a guest in the studio this morning, Margaret Butler, who is with, what is your official title, Margaret Butler?
Director.
Director.
Yeah, we've dropped the executive part, but for grants sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, so Director of Jobs with Justice?
Portland Jobs with Justice.
Excellent, excellent. And so Margaret's going to be talking about the anniversary celebration today. And later in the program, we're going to be talking about the report that was released yesterday by the Portland Police Bureau on traffic stops. And we're going to be talking about whether or not the data supports communities' belief that the Portland Police Department uses racial profiling as a tool in traffic and pedestrian stops as it relates to people of color. So, got a really full agenda today. Mm-hmm. And welcome, welcome, and it's a pleasure to have you here, Margaret.
You're welcome, Margaret.
It's great to be here.
Well, you know, I can remember back, way back in the dawn of 1991 when you were out there with a handful of people causing all sorts of trouble, and now look at
So how does that change?
Well,
the handful's grown.
That's the important thing.
Well, that's a good thing.
You know, like, what was the initial cadre you got together for Jobs with Justice?
Well, we started with about probably seven unions, and the Rainbow Coalition and Oregon Fair Share at the time were the founding organizations. In April of 91, we had a founding meeting. And really, the Rainbow Coalition had been talking about setting up a labor solidarity phone tree for a while. But then when we found out about this idea of Jobs with Justice,
and
we decided.
Last count, your membership is now?
Well, our pledge base is about 3,200 people.
And how many organizations?
84.
Yeah, a little bit of growth there.
Yeah, a little bit of growth.
And what sort of prompted Jobs with Justice coming together at that time back in the early 90s?
Jobs with Justice actually started nationally 20 years ago, and it was a response to all the concession bargaining and the way workers were taking the hit in the mid-80s. So the first campaign nationally was around Eastern Airlines. Remember that?
Eastern Airlines, whoa.
Frank Lorenzo.
Uh-huh.
And all of that.
And what was the first campaign the Portland chapter did?
Well, besides health care, I mean, we really thought there was a chance to fix the broken health care system in the early 90s.
Even back in the early 90s.
Wow. Right. So we did two health care action days, and the first official action of Jobs with Justice was to wrap the Blue Shield Blue Cross building in red tape. Which was really fun. We did an ambulance drive, collected ballots for people voting for a single payer system that were taken in ambulances across the country. And then, of course, the Clinton plan all fell apart, and we're back doing healthcare action days every year, trying to build the constituency for real reform.
Well, you know, the thing, I think one of the things you were saying about having fun, and that's been, like, to me, one of the key elements of Jobs with Justice is bringing back this sense of not only the importance of the issues you're working on, but, you know, let's have a little fun while we're yanking the tail of capitalism.
Right.
And Jobs with Justice has just been a real well of brilliant and fun ideas.
Some of them were yours too, Dave.
So here we go.
We certainly remember the series of actions at Tony Roma's to support the minimum wage campaign. And we did four actions Friday night after Friday night, started with eight people handing out beans that said Tony Roma's Cares Beans to low-wage workers. And then we did a picket line and leafleted in their parking lot. The next week we had about 60 people and went inside, and Jamie dressed up as Marie Antoinette and passed out cake.
And for folks who don't know Jamie's about 6'5", maybe weighs 180 pounds tops.
Hops,
in an evening dress and a beehive hairdo.
The visual is incredible. Yeah.
It was pretty funny. And then the next week, Michael Moore was with us, and we had about 250 people. Mm-hmm. And by this time, they'd threatened to sue us. And Michael Moore was supposed to go up to the door and engage the management around supporting the minimum wage campaign, but he actually didn't make it to the rally till when we went to Nike Town, which was the next stop, which he was more interested in. So anyway, we got sued for that, but we're there and Tony Romans is not.
So the moral of the story is don't mess with jobs with justice, okay?
Yeah.
One of the things that you've been really effective at is really engaging, especially a lot of the unions that like represent really low-wage workers, and really getting those individuals involved in campaigns to make their working conditions better.
Yeah, I think we've certainly prioritized low-wage workers and the struggles of workers of color. So that we prioritize the Justice for Janitors campaign, support for the Farm Workers Union. Last summer, SEIU had a contract campaign at Emanuel, which was a lot of low-wage workers.
It's kind of amazing because you don't think of low-wage workers when you think of a hospital, right? You think, how is that possible that you would have, you know, hospitals charge an arm and half of your leg. Right. So how is it possible they would have low-wage workers?
Right. And when you look at where the money goes, it isn't into the workers' pocket.
Right.
And Legacy and Providence control 82% of the market in the Portland area.
Wow. You know, we should connect because, you know, in my other life at Oregon Action, healthcare has become one of our big statewide issues. And you know, our goal is universal health care because we believe everybody should have some basic level of health care. But we also know that that's not a one-year campaign, you know,
right.
Is that you have to start working to build towards universal health care. But I think if any place in the country can do it, we can certainly do it. And we could do it a lot better than Massachusetts did.
Right, right. Yes, absolutely.
And so what do you want people to know about what's this is the anniversary celebration, and what's the 10th year anniversary, 15?
No, this is 15.
15-year anniversary.
So this Saturday is our big fundraising celebratory dinner at the Teamsters Hall at 6 o'clock. Today's the day we have to let the caterer know how many people are coming. So if you haven't called to say you're coming.
So cable listeners, you know, get on the phone now.
But if people show up at the door with money in their hand.
We will not.
You'll probably take it, huh?
And you've got another event coming up. I think it's a really important one because it has to do with, you know, the whole idea of this community labor coalition and sort of reintroducing working class ideas back into the community, and that's this Workers' Rights Board.
Right.
Why don't you tell folks a little bit about the Workers' Rights Board and what's going to be happening here soon?
The Workers' Rights Board started in 1999, and it's our way of involving community leaders in these worker struggles as they come along. And mostly what the Workers' Rights Board does is do public hearings to shine a public light on a situation of injustice for working people. And that can be kind of broad. We did a immigrant rights, workers' rights board hearing right after the Freedom Ride came back. That was really, really good. But quite often it's around the right to organize. And this one is focused on getting a fair ground rules for Providence workers who are organizing with the Service Employees Union. And Secretary of State Bill Bradbury is going to chair the panel, convene it. So it's Workers' Rights Board Fair Election Oversight Commission, because the whole thrust of it is how do you get a fair election in a union campaign, because the rules are stacked against workers. Mm-hmm. And It's really exciting. So Mary King, the chair of the Economics Department at Portland State, is going to be on the panel. Reverend Mother Alcina Boozer from St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church. Father Jack Mossbrucker is a Catholic institution. Rabbi Joey Wolf. Dr. Jill Ginsberg from Kaiser and Dick Springer are going to be the panel. And we're really excited because every time workers get a chance to tell their story in public, it's a very moving experience. And that's Thursday, May 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Portland building.
Terrific. Terrific. And
What time is that on the 25th?
It's 6 p.m. 6 to 8.
Okay. Now, once you've celebrated your 15th year, what's the next big mountain you guys are going to take on, a big fight you're going to take on?
Well, I think the most hopeful thing for me right now is the immigrants uprising. Mm-hmm. And we've been playing an ally role to the immigrant organizations that are leading that struggle here in Portland. And we think our role is to continue to do that, to help mobilize, mm-hmm. but also to do a lot of education mm-hmm. in the labor movement. Mm-hmm. So we're planning for a forum this summer, mm-hmm. and there's a planning meeting next week about that for union folks who want to think about how mm-hmm. to educate the people around them. We do have a PowerPoint, Unions and Immigrant Workers, which we're going to revise. Mm-hmm. But that's the mass movement we've been waiting for, you know.
Exactly.
It's just so exciting.
Incredible. And as you say, it's going to be a little rough. I mean, it's going to take some education because clearly
right. There
is some resentment there that these people are taking jobs, but, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it was wonderful around May Day to see the month before, to see so many different progressive organizations mm-hmm. come together and say, and I think maybe for one of the first times, how do we support your effort rather than here's our effort and you should be involved.
Yeah.
You know, but it was really clear, how do we support your effort? And the mm-hmm. result of that, I think, was a lot of good relationships starting to be built and some real long-term potential for some real a serious movement that's grassroots led. I mm-hmm. mean, people on cable are tired of listening to me say, you know, this country's ready for a movement, and it has to be really led by people of color.
Right.
Because that's really going to be how we're going to move this forward. And so May 1st was the day that gave me hope. You know, it's like, okay, I think we've got this now. I think we're on the right track and we're moving in the right direction. So I'm really appreciative to see that there's this acknowledgement that that it's okay to play a support role in supporting other people for their equal rights. So
right.
So I'm just thrilled about that.
Well, I think it's the only place that a boycott or a strike of that magnitude could have come from.
Exactly.
You know, people mm-hmm. from Mexico and Central America get...
Right. Oh,
get
yeah, they get strikes. They get strikes.
For
right.
a political reason.
That's right.
Which our workers who grew up here really don't
right,
get.
Yeah. They don't have that same mindset. But it was fabulous watching, and I'm still, and hopefully Jobs for Justice will be the organization that actually identifies what the economic impact was to have so many immigrant workers not working for one day. Because, you know, I keep looking for it in the Oregonian, I keep looking for it in the Portland Tribune, yeah. I keep looking for this data, and for some reason, it's just not showing up.
Yeah, I know a lot of the national organizations have been working on trying to figure it out.
I know one thing that stood out in my mind on May Day as I was flipping through the channels,
right.
watching the various actions across the country was the amount of times in different cities you saw that all familiar sign, Jobs with Justice.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
The picket signs, which have just become an icon for the whole rebirth of the labor movement. But, oh, look, in Colorado, there's Jobs with Justice. Here's in Portland. It's just, you're everywhere.
503-231-8187. We're having a lot of fun, but you guys could really call in and ask questions. We're talking to Margaret Butler. She's the director of Portland Jobs with Justice, and they're just about to celebrate their 15th year anniversary of working to make life better for workers in the Portland metro area. 503-231-8187. That's the number.
That's right.
In case you were quick, didn't quite get it written down. And so tell me, Margaret, so what is the state of the labor movement? You know, from what we hear on the outside, you know, labor has been beaten to a pulp. No easy questions here.
Now, I promise you, I wouldn't
think so. That's so far from the truth.
Yeah.
The attack on unions started in the 70s, started in the Carter administration, and in spite of everybody's best efforts, we really have not been able to turn it around. It's only the last couple of years that we stayed even in terms of the percentage of union workers, and I think that's had a huge impact on health care, on the pension stuff, on everything. But there are some unions doing good organizing work, and I was very worried about the split last year, but I think for Portland Jobs with Justice, it actually makes our role more important as a place where people can come together, and we do work and support with people, people on both sides. And in Oregon, the split, the tensions around the split are not nearly as deep
as they are back east.
Oh, my goodness.
And for non-union listeners, the split being the walkout of some unions from the AFL-CIO, creating a coalition to win?
A change to win.
Change to win.
Right. Right.
You knew it was a C thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, everybody's really trying to figure out how to turn things around. But I still think that building the power in the streets is the way it has to happen. And again, I go back to May Day was an incredible thing. And a lot of unions on both sides were in the streets with immigrants.
Okay, we got a few callers. Good morning, caller. Welcome to Cable.
Hi, this is Spencer from St. John. And with May Day, I was kind of wondering, I mean, that in St. John's, I really didn't see a whole lot of discernible impact from kind of the immigrant boycott. And and maybe you could talk a little bit about how there were some effects in around Portland and what you guys saw.
Okay.
There were a lot of businesses that did shut down. My coworker went and took pictures of some of the signs in business windows. Quantifying the effect, I think, is rather difficult. Certainly, the schools can tell you how many students took the day off, and there were lots of students.
I heard a lot of reports, like fast food places in Gresham, for example, were impacted pretty severely, and a number of them closed. And that actually got reported in the mainstream press.
Several people who went to Fred Meyer on Sunday nights at several different Fred Meyer said it was packed with Latino people doing their shopping the night before.
You got to catch up. That's why you got to get this stuff done ahead of time. And so, and clearly, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people in the streets downtown Portland on May Day. And there was also a huge rally with thousands of people in Salem. And so, you know, even though it may not have made it over the St. John's, I mean, I think that the impact really was felt all across the state because, you know, I have never seen anything like it, even though we've been doing anti-war protests for, quite a bit. But what was really wonderful about this protest was everybody was represented. I mean, it wasn't just about being an immigrant, but it was about standing in solidarity with immigrants. And so you saw people from all walks of life fully participating in the effort. And for me, that was like really the highlight because that's what we need.
And it was entire family showing up. It was another thing that was unique. And think about it, May Day was actually preceded by a couple of previous large actions by immigrants.
That's
right.
They've been like these rolling number of actions.
On April 9th, everybody built for a big march in Salem, about 20,000 people. But April 10th was the National Day of Action, and nobody had organized for the 10th. It got announced on Spanish language media, and it got announced at rallies. But nobody did any organizing, and 8,000 people
showed up.
And I was like, oh, my God.
But, you know, it talks about the power of media, you know. And so having the ability to use Spanish language media to really mobilize community members are key. And, you know, it's funny that you say that, you know, well, we announced, you know, the announcement was on Spanish language radio and all of a sudden 8,000 people show up. We keep telling candidates for office that, you know, if you really want to influence people, you need to be on a Spanish language TV or radio so that, you know, that people know that your money is where your mouth is, you know, because we tend to talk a lot about wanting diversity, but it's normally in theory. We'll talk a bit more about that when we get into the later program today. And so the Saturday program is open to...
Well, it is our big fundraising dinner, so it's $50 for a ticket, but we have a bunch of scholarship tickets as well, so people should call the office today.
And that number is?
503-236-5573.
503-236-5573.
And there are going to be some fun things happening there, I assume, tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday.
Yeah.
Saturday.
Yeah, the keynote speaker is, oh, boy, I didn't do this part. Boca, I think his last name is, I don't remember his last name, I'm sorry. Mm. He's a leader in the Latino community in Seattle.
Oh,
and
cool.
He's great on immigrant rights and on workers' issues. Mm-hmm. So he's the keynote speaker. And then we'll have music and workers thanking Jobs with Justice for the work over the year and the pledger countdown. And I'm working on the PowerPoint. It's 15 years of action. So
consolidating up the PowerPoint.
Yeah, so I'm just going through all the pictures, which
excellent.
Is really fun.
I bet. So we're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Carla. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Leah, and I have two questions. One is for Joanne. When you were on last time, you talked about some listening projects, activities that were going to be happening.
Yes.
And I missed that. Would you be willing to give out that information again?
You're going to be so tired of it by the time this program's over because I'm going to announce it over and over and over again.
Okay.
Okay?
That's fine. And then I wanted to ask the your guest, what recently I have learned about a political group called the Working Families Party. And I'm wondering if there's any collaboration going on between the work that she is doing and the Working Families Party, and if she would, or any others similar to that, coalition building kind of things that might be happening. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about the Working Families Party. Is an effort to establish a party that represents and focuses on working families issues. They're currently collecting 19,000 signatures to get listed officially as a party and appear on ballots, and certainly we work closely with a lot of people who are involved in that effort. We don't do candidate and electoral politics stuff, but speaking personally, I think that the idea of fusion voting, which would be the next step, and that means somebody could run as a Democrat and as a working families candidate, so you could count how many votes the person got through the working families' work and effort, would help make a difference in holding people to a set of principles that certainly I think workers would mostly agree on.
Mm-hmm. 503-231-8187 is the number of the call. This is KBOO Portland. We're going to take the next caller. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. How are you?
Wonderful. How about you?
Good. I kind of caught the tail end. We're talking about illegal immigration or illegal aliens?
No, we're actually talking about, we have the director on from Jobs with Justice, so we're talking about organizing for fair wages and health care and all that good stuff. We started talking about May 1st because we were talking about how you build a movement. And talking about the immigrant rights movement as a model for how you move forward a people's rights agenda.
Okay.
So did you have something?
Do we mean, what's that?
I was just going to say, so you have something you want to add to that dialogue?
Well, no, I mean, are we talking about, and I believe in rights for workers, but are we talking the rights for immigrants that have come across this border legally or illegally? What is there a difference there?
Well, let me tell you what I feel personally. My personal view is that no living creature can be illegal. By accident of birth, we all end up being born where we're born.
Okay, but should we, and let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Should we should people who come into this nation obey the laws of this nation and come through our laws that we have created?
Well, if the laws are discriminatory as to who they allow to come into the country, for example, if you're from Cuba, we open arms for you. But if you're from, you know, pick another island, you know, we say no way, shape, or form. So, the law should be just for everybody.
Okay, but I agree with you. The law should be just. But the laws are what they are, and they have been established by elected officials that we have elected. So shouldn't we then obey the laws?
Well,
shouldn't everybody who comes into this nation obey the laws that we have? I mean, when my folks came from Europe, they had to obey the laws and go through all the procedures that our laws had established. And like when Canadians come through, they need to obey the laws. When Europeans continue to come into this country, they have to continue obeying the laws. When Asians come here, they have to obey the laws. But it seems like for the Latin Americans and Mexicans, they can come across, run across that nut illegally, and they don't have to obey the law. So why is there a difference?
Okay, hang on for a sec. We have someone that wants to jump in and try to answer
that.
Yeah,
I'd love to answer that. Actually, Tom Chamberlain from the AFL-CIO, who used to be a firefighter and the union president of the firefighters, says, if you set someone's house on fire and then try and slam the door when they run to your house, that's not exactly very good. What happened in 94 when the North American Free Trade Area was passed was 2 million Mexican farmers were driven off their land. A lot of them went to the border to work in maquila factories that then moved to China and other places. And so there is an economic crisis created by U.S. policies in Mexico and Central America, and the trade policies that we drive are still...
So we're blaming the United States again, right?
Excuse
we're
me?
Always, we're blaming the United States.
Let her finish.
Now, you know, we're going to have a dialogue, so you asked your question, and she's trying to answer, and we'll be happy to come back and let you ask another question, and we can continue to debate it, but we do want to be respectful of differences in opinion.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish. So illegal immigration dropped 18% in the couple of years before NAFTA and rose 62% after NAFTA. There's reasons why people would leave their homes, families, and countries, and they have to do with an economic crisis. And so the real answer to the problem of people coming to the country is to set up economic policies that are just for U.S. workers and for people in the other countries.
Okay, that's fine. Now, if every nation in the world had economic problems and everybody wanted to come to this nation illegally, would we allow that? Or would we still follow the guidelines and laws that we have established as a nation?
No, I think you're missing the point. I think the answer is, should we not instead adjust our foreign economic policies so they are not disrupting indigenous economies? We go about the world encouraging countries to adopt export economies. They can't feed their own people. They can't employ their own people. These are economies that are often quite volatile and unstable. We then do that, and when it has the adverse effect of displacing millions of people who then need to find a way to make a living, we raise the hue and cry that these people are illegal aliens coming here just to get what we want. We have to live in the place where we're standing and accept responsibility, not just for what we do here within the boundaries of our own country, but what we're doing throughout the globe. And until we do that...
When do we draw the line?
Okay, let him finish, and then we'll come back and let you have at it.
The line being drawn is when we begin acting like a nation as an adult in this global village rather than some large spoiled brat is what I think. So, you know, we need our foreign policy. Pardon?
Again, you're blaming the United States.
I'm accepting responsibility for our country's actions, which is what adults do. Now, we can behave.
You ask me who's at fault here, I think Vicente Fox has caused an atmosphere of poverty in his nation because he knows that millions of people are going to cross the border into the United States, work here, and then send half of their wages back to his country. country. So he has no incentive to make his nation better because he knows he doesn't have to because he's got the golden pot next door.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because on the same token, the people in his country, the United States, is taking full advantage of them. I mean, if you think about,
I agree, you think about
like manufacturing, like some of the things that we used to make here, they used to be living wage jobs, used to be a job. You didn't actually have to go to college. You could actually be able to afford to raise a family decently, with a union wage job. And what did we do in this country? What we decided to do was send all those jobs to countries where we can pay people 20 cents an hour, right? And so our CEOs are getting really rich, and they're making a lot of money. But who's
part of that problem is our environmental laws and our government regulations are forcing these corporations just to make a profit to leave our country.
But see, okay, you asked me the question about, you know, whether or not people should be able to come across various borders
illegally,
right?
So I
want to ask you this question. How much is enough profit, right? When you are in business, you are in business to make money. There's no question about if you are a responsible business owner, aren't you concerned about what happens to your employees? Aren't you concerned about...
I employ 16 legal Hispanic people, which I pay probably double or more of what minimum wage is, who I've helped buy homes here, who I've helped establish lives here.
Okay, so it sounds like you're...
I make about a 10-15% profit, which sometimes 20. I'm very happy with that.
Okay, and so you sound like a very responsible business owner, right? You're someone that's not just about the bottom line dollar, but you're also concerned at making sure that the people who work for you can have a quality of life for themselves and their families, right?
But I make sure they're legal and they're here properly, and we've talked about this, and I've actually sat down with all my guys 2 weeks ago and said, how do you feel about the current situation? Every single one of them was against the fact that their own countrymen are not coming across this country the way they had to, the way, you know, through the paperwork that they had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
They themselves are against it.
Well, you know, I probably would say that, too, if I had an employer that controlled whether or not I was able to feed my family or not, you know. But let's just assume that what they said was right, right? Let's assume that they think that this is like really bad that people are coming across illegally and not going through the appropriate paperwork. Be that as it may, this is where we are today. So what do we do from this point on, right? Even if I agreed with you that people should use the appropriate channels, even knowing what I know, which is that, you know, you have to be the right color in order to get the appropriate immigration status to be able to come into this country, it's appalling to me that any European that wants to immigrate to this country, they have no problem at all. It's a welcome mat. Come on in. We're glad to have you. But if you look like me, boy, you got to answer. I'm telling you, this is a fact. I'm telling you that this is a fact.
We don't allow African Americans in.
I'm saying that if you are a person of color,
you know how many immigrants from Africa have immigrated. I see foreign African Americans here all the time.
But see, listen to my whole story, please.
All right.
I mean, I patiently listen to you, so listen to my story.
Go ahead.
So if I am from a country, right, that the majority of the populations are people of color, it is not the same immigration process that I would go through if I was coming from a European country. I'm telling you this is fact. And Cuba's a perfect example, right? Now, you could be from Cuba or you could be from Haiti. If you're from Haiti, no, they won't even let the boat land, you know? If you're coming in on a boat from Haiti, you're just SOL, you're out of luck. We don't want any part of you. But if you're coming from Cuba because we don't like Fidel... Because we don't like him, if you're coming from Cuba, we'll take as many people from Cuba as want to come to the U.S.
How about the little boy who Clinton sent back? He was Cuban.
Well, you know, there was a fight because they wanted him back, right? It became an international incident.
Well, then your theory doesn't stand. I mean, and any Cuban theory... wrote that stuff, then we send him back.
Well, wait a minute. Now, if you remember, in that particular case, there was people that were, there were U.S. officials demanding that that kid stay in the U.S., right? And his dad, his blood father, was the one that fought the U.S. government to get his son back. The U.S. was putting all their resources in keeping that kid here.
Well, Dad, we got Clinton to thank for that, huh?
Well, you know, this has been fun. I appreciate you calling because, you know, even though you and I disagree on some fundamental issues, it sounds like...
Hey, the only thing I'm saying is if we're going to obey some laws, we got to obey all the laws.
Well, I want to tell you that I am not a fan of obeying laws that are discriminatory. You know, I am not a fan of that, and I don't care if they're our laws, because I don't think our lawmakers always make the right choices.
Hey, then if you don't feel that way, Joanna, as a former lawmaker in Salem, vote him out.
Oh, and don't I try. I try. I try every single election day. Believe me, I try to get him out.
Well, maybe you're not working hard enough, Joanna.
Well, you know, when only 32% of the people participate in a primary election, and then the next day they're still moaning and groaning and complaining about how bad things are, I don't have a lot of empathy for them.
I agree with you.
You have a great day, sir. Thank you so much for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Oh, he got our blood circulating this morning,
sure
didn't he?
Well, everybody's awake now.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're talking to Margaret Butler. And she is the director of Portland's Jobs with Justice. And my wonderful co-host here with me today,
Dave Mazza.
In the flesh. And so, Margaret, we're going to be finishing up this segment. So what are the last... points you want to make before we move into our next conversation?
Well, I just think that more and more people are understanding what's been happening to working people. Mm-hmm. The healthcare is in crisis. Pensions are in crisis. Working conditions, wages are in crisis. And so the potential for really turning things around is greater than it's ever been at the height of this crisis for working folks. And I think the immigrant rights movement is key. It is a workers' movement, and we all need to get behind it and figure out how to move massive numbers of people demanding change.
Or we can blame the immigrants rather than those fat cat CEOs.
Exactly.
Well, I mean... You know, but the important thing about that caller is we have to be able to engage people where they are.
Absolutely.
You know, and for that particular caller, he's at least in one place doing good work. He says that he's making sure that his employees have the opportunity for home ownership, that he's actually working with them, paying them a decent salary so they have a living wage, so they can feed their family, so they can afford to buy a home. And so... You know, so let's compliment on what he's doing.
Absolutely.
Right. But on the same token, we've got to challenge those misperceptions that somehow it's these people that are doing something to us.
Right.
And it's actually what we've done to them that have forced them to come here in the first place. So, you know, but we have to be able to dialogue and have those conversations. So.
And let's not even get into the point that we stole their whole country from them.
Right. I know. We don't even want to go there. Right. Okay, let's take one more caller, and then we'll just segue into our next call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boot.
Are you advocating the discontinuance of representative government? Or are you wanting us to abrogate?
No, I'm actually advocating that people actually use the system that's in place.
Wait.
Okay.
You're contradicting yourself. A government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Right.
If you don't like what's happening with the government is us, you change it through due process. You don't simply abrogate the whole thing. And that seems to be what you're advocating. And now, wait. I want to make a point.
Wait. You can't keep telling me that.
Wait.
I have the mic.
You've been on the... Hang on a minute.
I have the mic.
It's not my response. It's not my fault. I don't think I should do penance or do reparation for what the multinational corporations are doing. I didn't elect that. So if you want to hold them responsible and cause the people who have made so much money out of the what's happened overseas and other and our economic foreign policies, even the CIA, look at all the harm they're done. But I don't think it's appropriate to try to completely abrogate the whole system of representative government, where you have legislators who are elected by due process by the electorate. I don't think you should throw that all over.
I didn't say you should.
Well, yes, you did.
No,
you said,
I didn't.
Look, immigration policy is enacted by through legislation like all other policy, as it should be. If you don't like it, change it. But don't simply ignore it. And don't simply excuse those who bypass our laws.
That is really easy for you to say. You can
it's
feed
It's very easy
you
for
can
me
feed
to say, lady,
kids.
Because I'm informed and I'm educated.
Nobody has moved your job to another country where you are desperate to feed your kids.
Hey,
okay?
Listen.
When you are in a desperate situation, you call me back and tell me that you will be a law-abiding citizen, because you're going to follow all the laws on the books.
Well, as long as I feel like I have a representative government, and as a legal citizen, I do. And when you're saying that anyone who chooses to, at their convenience, can ignore our laws.
I did not say that.
Yes,
why
you
do
did.
You people keep
yes,
putting
you
words
did,
in my mouth?
Lady, you did.
I did no such thing.
You don't understand the architecture of government or the process.
Oh, I don't understand government?
Yes, you don't.
Okay.
You don't. Goodbye.
You've had your 30 seconds. You have a great day, kind sir. You've been listening to Voices from the Edge. See what you started, Margaret? No, just
that's
easy.
That's really interesting.
Just easy.
Welcome to the world. Right.
Welcome
radio.
To our world, yes. Well, we thank you very much for being here this morning, Margaret,
yes.
And congratulations to Jobs with Justice for celebrating 15 years of standing up for workers' rights. And I wish you at least twice as many years to come.
Great.
Making sure that workers have a voice in what happens in their lives. So thank
That's
you.
Right.
Great. And I'm looking forward to hearing the second half of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. This
well, and I'm sure
great.
I'm going to get some callers that are going to disagree with me on
I'm
that
sure
part, too.
I'm sure you are, too.
So
can't
thank
believe
you.
That'll happen.
Yeah. Oh, come on. We've been around here long enough. So we're going to actually segue now into talking about some other data that's been developed. Yesterday, Acting Police Chief Rosie Sizer released the latest numbers on traffic stops by Portland police officers. And they released numbers from 2004 and 2005. The listening audience may remember that back in 2001, there was a blue ribbon panel put together on racial profiling to look at, because the community continued to say that that they believe that Portland police officers used race as a factor in making traffic and pedestrian stops. And so the police bureau's response to that was to start developing this process whereby they would record racial data in traffic stops and do a yearly report back to the community about what those findings were. And so yesterday we got 2 years' worth of reports in, and what and basically what the report says is, like, not a lot has changed.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's kind of the bottom line, is that the numbers are consistent. In fact, the numbers are pretty much the same as they were back when the first report came out in 2001. It basically says that if you're African American, you are 3 times more likely to be stopped and searched in a traffic stop. If you are Latino, you are twice as likely to be stopped and searched in a traffic stop. And if you are white or Asian, you are underrepresented in the number of stops that are made based on the numbers that you have in the population.
And then the interesting piece to that is, in looking at what actually comes out of those stops,
right.
Whites are more apt to be found carrying weapons
or
drugs
yes.
than blacks or Latinos. So clearly,
49361?
The rate of stops, or the reason the stops are happening, are not producing, these sort of results that one would anticipate. It was kind of interesting that the chief didn't really address that during the meeting, though.
No, that's very true. one of the other things that really stuck out for me was the, as you said, the number of people who are stopped, and you find that there was nothing. And the data actually is broken down. You've got citywide data, mm-hmm. and then you've got data that's specific to individual precincts. And so, of course, I went directly to Northeast Precinct, and the numbers show that a third of the African Americans that are stopped and searched, they're found to have nothing illegal going on at all. No wrongdoing, no traffic violations, no nothing. To me, that number is way too high. Mm-hmm. It seems there's a problem with that, because how could a third of the people you stop, if you've been trained, if you've been, working with this population, how is it possible
right.
that you would be stopping that many people for no reason? And so, one of the things that I'm working on in partnership, actually, with the Portland Police Bureau and with the mayor's office, is we're doing these series of community listening sessions, and the first one is tonight in Brentwood, Darlington. But there'll be one around each of the police precinct areas, and a goal is to have a process where the community gets to report directly back to the police what their experiences have been. So part of the program will be the community reporting back. Then one part will be police officers saying, based on our training, policies, instincts, this is what we go through when we're making a decision about a traffic stop, so that the community hears directly from police officers what is the thought process that mm-hmm. they're going through when they're making these stops. To me, the most important part will be the last half hour, where the police and community will, in small group discussions, come up with what are the solutions, what are the next steps, what are the policy changes, what are the community recommendations, where do we go from here to make sure that we eliminate racial profiling in our police department.
Now, the people you're going to be having from the force, these are the actual officers out doing the patrols.
That's correct. So we'll have... Chief Sizer will be at each one. The command staff from each precinct will be there, but there will also be at least five officers who are responsible for patrol mm-hmm. in those precinct areas. Mm-hmm. Because it's important to have the folks that meet people
right.
on the street. Because I think, you know, if you just had the command staff, you could say that this is what's happening, but it's a lot different when you're actually talking to the folks that are actually on the street.
Right, right. Well, and I think it's good that citizens will be able to sort of, push the envelope a little and
exactly.
see what happens.
Exactly. And, and Dave, I know you've been at some of those meetings where folks have come out and they cuss out the police chief mm-hmm. for the night, and then people go home and nothing really comes out
right.
of that. And that's really not our goal here at all, which is why a lot of people have been, and the way we've set these up is that we do a training early in the week for the Thursday listening session, because we want people to be prepared to come with their statements written out,
mm-hmm.
to be able to say their statements in less than 2 minutes, because the goal is not to get into anybody's individual story,
right.
but to really talk about what's been the community impact of policing in this community.
Well, I commend you on the way you've organized this, because having organized speakouts before,
mm-hmm.
it's really difficult, because these are people who oftentimes are walking wounded, and
exactly.
they so want to be heard.
Yes.
And it's tough to just tell them,
right.
it's about more than you in this
exactly.
case.
Exactly. And, and so for those cases, for people who didn't do the pre-training, there are some written surveys that people can fill
mm-hmm.
out that will be incorporated into the overall report that comes back at the end. But it's really important that it's done in a fashion that actually creates dialogue.
Right.
And that's what our goal is. Back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to cable. Hello? Hello, hello?
We seem to have lost
Hi, them. Caller. Are you there? Nope, doesn't appear to be. But so anything... Good morning, caller.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about immigration, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I came to this country legally, and I applied for my residency, and I obviously ran into a problem with immigration. And I just wanted to let you know that I agree with you. If you are not from European countries, you are in trouble already. For a small problem that I had with immigration, they made me run around for 7 or 8 years.
Wow. Mm.
This is when I came to this country legally. They were telling me you shouldn't have been able to come. And I said, your embassy in Switzerland has given me visa. You know, you may want to take that up with them. I'm
right, 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 right.
That was one issue.
Right.
Now, in my view, and I have the documentation, I can sit down and talk about immigration for days
mm-hmm.
and tell you about my experience and what I went through. Immigration is the most backward, ineffective organization. They don't even obey the law themselves, okay? And on top of it, usually if you go to any other organization in this country, at least you can go back and maybe file a complaint or go to a lawyer or do something about it, and somebody has to respond to you. With immigration, the bad part is that there are a lot of immigration lawyers there, and I'm not saying all of them are bad. No, I'm
right.
pretty sure there are those that are ethical and they support, you know, their clients.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a ton of them that make a living out of people like me, which were vulnerable. They were terrified. They didn't know what to do.
Right.
I'm not going to name anybody, but there was an immigration lawyer in Seattle that I was using. You should have seen his office. His pictures with, you know, President Reagan was all over the place.
Right.
He was supposed to be one of the mm-hmm. best. He was nothing but a fraud.
Oh,
for
wow.
2 years, he was collecting money from me, did nothing. Who am I supposed to go to? Here I am yeah. trying to obey the law.
Right.
Here I am trying to say, for 7 or 8 years, I couldn't even get a response from immigration. It's the most ineffective, frustrating organization. In addition to that, I have had situations that my wife and I and our lawyer have gone there. The person that was supposed to look at our files, first of all, they always said, oh, your file is not there. We have lost it, number one. Number two, he would make really, you know, obscene and derogatory remark. And here I am sitting there in front of my wife, in front of my lawyer. All of us are turning red, but we couldn't say anything. He just gets up and leaves his office.
Wow.
In what other organization can do this to people? So to those that they say, oh, you know, there is immigration.
Legally. Right.
And you have to obey the law.
Right.
I'm all for obeying the law.
Right.
Problem is that immigration himself doesn't do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you happen to be from certain countries, or if you are not European, you are just totally in a different organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife is a U.S. citizen, and I had traveled with her all around the world. And it's funny when we get in the line and she goes through so easily.
Right, no problem.
And I'm always stuck, you know, and I have to explain myself. It's just I had horrible experience with immigration.
Mm.
Okay, when I was graduating on the top of my class as an engineering student, all the other students were interviewing with, you know, top companies in the country. I couldn't because I had no status.
Right.
Anyway, I didn't want to take too much.
No, I appreciate you calling in because it's really important that there's a counter to the earlier caller for someone who's lived that experience. So I really appreciate you taking the time to call and share that with us today. And keep telling your story because there's a lot of people that need to know the real story rather than what they're seeing on the evening news or what they're talking about at
mm-hmm.
the coffee cooler, because it's the real stories that are going to make the difference and make the changes that need to happen.
I just wanted to add one more comment, if I may.
Okay.
After I went through several lawyers that they really didn't do much for me, I finally was able to find a lawyer who was very expensive, somebody that usually immigrants cannot afford it, but my in-laws were helping me,
mm-hmm.
helping me with that. And he was trying to, based on there was a law at the time, information law, that he could finally go and access my file in immigration. Before that, everything was a mystery, you know, and immigration would never tell us, okay, what are the issues, what are the problems, okay. Even after that, half of the documentations that he got, what they were blacked out. So, and I have copies of those.
Mm.
It was just the most frustrating the most, you know, I cannot even begin to explain.
That sounds like the purpose of it. It was supposed to frustrate you to the point where you just gave up.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
All I got from immigration was a letter to leave this country in 11 days, and
Whoa.
That was it.
You know, I am absolutely positive that there are many, 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 many more stories like yours out there. And mm-hmm. again, I really appreciate you calling this morning.
Thank you so much.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So there's talk about a real life example
yeah.
of what we were talking about with that previous caller, that, you know, it our policy is not, if our policy was fair, then, you know, then you're right. Anybody who wanted to legally migrate would be able to.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly our policy is we pick and choose who's worthy
exactly.
of our policy. And that's why we end up where we are today. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
At a recent meeting with Mayor Potter, we asked about those numbers. And he was concerned that they hadn't been released for a few years.
Right.
Happy to see that they did it. My concern is that they probably didn't because they said the same thing over and over again.
Exactly.
And I don't know what's been done in the interim to change it at all.
Well, I mean, to me, that's the sad part. The sad part is that they haven't changed.
Right.
So if they haven't changed, that means that we're just doing things the way we've always done it.
Right. But we've got numbers now.
But we've got numbers to show that they, in fact, haven't changed.
Right. And if we added pedestrians to the numbers,
right.
it probably would be even more
mm-hmm.
outrageous.
Exactly, exactly.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the police officers, but also the policies and procedures of this city. You know, when they use the statistics for the drug-free zones, the statistic they use is the number of arrests in an area, not the number of convictions.
Uh-huh, which is a big difference in those numbers.
Right, so if you continue to profile people and stop them on the chance that you might find drugs on them, a third of them won't,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, you'll get high numbers of arrests. But that doesn't say anything about convictions. And to tie this into immigration, what concerned me most about the president's recent speech, well, two things. One is that he keeps saying that the immigrants are doing jobs that Americans won't do, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what those jobs are.
Right.
Americans won't do. There's
right.
a lot of Americans that don't have jobs, and unfortunately, the unemployment rate among young African Americans is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that it's jobs that Americans have been taught they don't have to accept the conditions that a lot of immigrants will tolerate because they're making more money than they would have made in their own country. And that says a lot for what's going on in their own country.
Right.
And I think you spoke to that
mm-hmm.
as far as how their infrastructures have been totally destroyed and there is absolutely no opportunity to make money in their own country, which is why they come here. What concerned me about the president's speech was that he said he was going to start enlisting the help of local law enforcement to enforce the immigration laws. And I don't know what that means exactly, but I see it as potentially being a lot more racial profiling.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that really surprised me, speaking about the numbers, is I wonder if the numbers for Latinos that are stopped are actually accurate, because the African-American population hasn't changed much over the last decade. The Latino population has. It's actually doubled or more than doubled in the last decade.
High.
I'm sorry?
Proportionately, it's still very high. They're twice as likely.
Well, but statistically, you would think that it would be even higher than that, right? Even being twice as high, you would think it would be about four times as high, and you would think the African American numbers would be a bit lower, just because of the numbers in the population.
On this certain wars on people, African Americans are still the primary target, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and that's what the data reflects as well. So,
I really would like to know exactly what he had in mind when he mentioned enlisting the help of local law enforcement agencies, because right now, as I understand it, law enforcement, local law enforcement isn't supposed to get involved in
immigration issues at all. Right.
Right.
Well, though, my guess is it will see something similar as we've been seeing with the whole terrorism thing. There'll be some federal dollars offered.
Right.
So anybody that looks like they might be a foreigner has the potential of being stopped.
Right. Now, instead of a joint terrorism task force, there'll be a joint immigration task force, and more of our resources for dealing with real community problems will get sucked into.
He did mention that funding would be provided.
Yeah.
Always like.
Oh yeah, they always come up with money for their pet projects.
It's part of the federalization of local police forces that's been going on for quite a while.
Right. So unless we get this nipped in the butt, I don't see it getting better. I see it getting worse.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And that's why I'm really glad that the police chief and the mayor have all committed to these community listening sessions, because it's not the answer, but it's the beginning of coming together to resolve these issues once and for all. Because
hopefully they'll look at their policies.
Yeah, well, right.
Allow these things to happen. You know, as long as you put the policy out there, which gives people the authority to do what they do.
Well, I mean, I think it's even more insidious than that. I mean, if, you know, the community has never been told what the process is for making these stops, right? And, you know, so as individuals, we make assumptions about, well, it must be because of X, or it must be because of Y.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to hearing directly out of the horse's mouth what they go through when they're making those decisions and before they make those stops. Not that I think that they're going to say, well, yeah, you know, well, there were four African Americans in the car. Yes, I was pretty sure they must have been up to something no good, right? I don't expect them to say that publicly at the meeting, but I expect them to give us some insight as to how they go through their thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And because, as you know, regardless of what the policy says, I mean, you remember back in, what was it, 91, when all across the state we had police chiefs signing the anti-profiling pledge, right?
Right, and that anti-profiling pledge had a clause at the end that said, except in extraordinary circumstances.
Oh, did it now?
Yes. And they never could explain.
I'm going to have to pull that out.
I asked the question. I said, what does that mean?
Right.
And the officer who was speaking actually had the audacity to say, well, maybe a black guy just raped somebody. I said, oh, so that means you get to stop every black man? So to me, that agreement was affront.
Well, I mean, but I think as the community, we've got some responsibility to hold them accountable. If this is what they say, this is how they say they want to act in the community, and yet their own numbers tells us that clearly that's not what's happening in practice, then we have some responsibility to make it so.
Right. Well, I appreciate your conversation.
Thank you for the call.
I gotta go. Talk to you later.
Have a great day. Coming up today on KBOO at 9, Carla Chavez hosts Chisismo, a program that examines the cultural evolution of the Mexican-American or Chicano. He'll have more on immigrant rights. So we'll keep talking immigrant rights this morning. That's a good thing. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell will host Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, the guest is a former soldier in the Israel Army who refused to serve in the occupied territories and was imprisoned in 2003. Since his release, he has been active in the Israeli Refuser Movement. At 10:15, the guest is Dr. Mary Wynn Ashford, the former president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. She'll speak in Portland this weekend on looking at the Iraq War using a medical paradigm. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard's guests are local port and sculptor Keith Gilliam and Stacy Fletcher. They'll discuss the work of noted sculptor Hilda Morris. And at 11, Democracy Now! Will look at proposed legislation that would rewrite Internet privacy rules and require service providers to track what users do online in order to help police to conduct criminal investigations. The show also looks at proposed changes by the Environmental Protection Agency that would dismantle the program which tracks the amount of toxic chemicals manufacturers release into the environment. So that's what's coming up today on KBOO.
Sounds like a full load there.
Sounds like we're going to have a very, very busy day. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hi.
I hear a lot of static to you.
Yeah, I hear it too. But
should I go ahead or what?
Yeah, let's just go with the flow. Hopefully it will go away.
Okay, I'm going back to the job. And
okay.
I know my country has messed up a lot of countries and is messing up this country. Yesterday, Barbara Bernstein had a person on the American Friends Service Committee.
Right.
And one of the things he said was that Mexico has created 20 billionaires, I guess it is. I don't know, since the Bush government or what. But what I'm curious about, because I have some Irish ancestors. Are you there?
I'm here, uh-huh.
Irish ancestors. I'm just wondering if that happened in Ireland also with billionaires and millionaires since Bush has been in. One more thing. Can we honestly, even though maybe not the best jobs that have gone out of this country to China and other countries from this country, can we honestly get some of them back? Anyway, thanks a lot for everything.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. That's a good question. Can we get some of those jobs back?
Yeah.
I actually think it depends on whether or not we hold those corporate business leaders responsible for their behavior. When they go to the legislative body and start moaning and groaning about their need for another tax break so they can be competitive, mm-hmm. does the people we elect to serve us actually challenge that theory? Do you really need a tax break, or what you do? Or is it that you're just once again trying to get so much more profit? When you've got companies that are collecting taxes and don't pay those taxes into the state general fund, why is it that we don't hold them accountable for that behavior? That's not appropriate, and we should be holding them accountable. So I think we've got a role in that, absolutely.
Well, I agree with you 100%.
You agree?
Joanne.
Okay,
back
to the phone line. Good morning, Carla. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks, Johan.
You're welcome.
Anyway, a couple of things that we always must keep in mind. The first one is the system is rigged.
Yep.
The system is rigged. So that's our first thing to keep in mind. And another thing to keep in mind is those who have waved the flag the highest have sold us down the river the fastest.
Amen.
I kind of wonder, the May 1st, protest was so well organized with so many people. I am thinking that we should recreate that with additional people,
mm-hmm.
and we should all head down to Vicente's house and say, hey, look up here, Buster. It's time to open up economic opportunities in this country as well, so that there's economic opportunity in Mexico as well as in this country.
Absolutely. Can you imagine what it must be like to have to leave your family to travel great distances under threat of harm or being killed or being abused? To travel to a country where you don't speak the language, or you are limited—you have limited ability to speak the language—and to be subject to people taking total advantage of you, paying you less than the minimum wage, paying you under the table, not treating you with the dignity that you deserve, and yet you put up with that over and over and over again because you've got a family that you've got to make sure has food and has a roof over their head. Just trying to put myself in the position of someone who has had to. When I look at a immigrant standing on the street corner as I come to KBOO every Thursday morning, and I see people lined up waiting for anybody and anybody that comes by with an offer of a job, I start trying to put myself in what it must have been like mm-hmm. to actually even get here in the first place, what it must be like to be out there at 6 o'clock in the morning hoping like heck you're the one chosen that day so you can make a little bit of money to feed your family. You know, have we lost our empathy in this country that we can't put ourselves in the shoes of our neighbor and wonder what that's like?
Well, this is, and not to be flip, but what it's like, it's waiting for a bad date.
It's like waiting for a bad date.
Yes. He invited you to dinner, and then you find out he wanted more, and then you say, hey. Hey, if I would have known that's what you wanted,
we wouldn't have started this date.
I could have gone to dinner with my friends, with people I really like.
I love cable callers. They are the most creative people that I have the pleasure of interacting with. But you're right. I mean, it's interesting
terrible.
To me, that there's so many of us who can't put ourselves in someone else's shoes.
I lived on the stories of my family. My grandparents came from Finland long time ago, you know, and the men worked in logging and fishing, you know, and they would leave the mama and the kids, you know, in a shack somewhere while they went down to fish, and you know, but at least there was something to do.
Exactly.
There was something to do. It was poor living, but at least they left horrible conditions, you know, to come here. But
right.
at least there was something to do. But
exactly.
even those things to do are gone.
That's very true. And right. I mean, you know, it's like the living wage jobs are disappearing, right?
And
we've got an administration that talks about the wonderful job growth. But what he doesn't tell you is that they're all minimum wage jobs
right.
with no benefits, all part time, you know. And so it's like, you know, it's like that's the truth of what's going on. But, you know, if you listen to the administration, you would think, well, everything's rosy. Everybody's just doing great and making lots of money. And why are these people over here bugging us?
And the purchasing power of minimum wage is about half of what it was
what it used to be.
So
let's not even talk about federal minimum wage, right? Because that's an insult.
Or in the South, you know, you have to practically buy a job.
Oh, yes. In the South, with $3 and something, $3.50 an hour, it's like, it's insane.
But unfortunately,
but anyway,
go ahead, caller.
Oh, I just think I think the idea of organizing a mass protest to go down to Vicente's house, because you know he and our administration are working together.
Oh, absolutely.
To keep both countries, you know, I mean, to keep the poor people of both countries
poor
in poverty.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best way to get cheap labor there is, right? Keep people ignorant. Keep them just barely surviving, and that's the way to make sure you build your power base. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate
it. Okay, thanks so much.
Appreciate your call. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're down to the last 10 minutes of the show.
Now
or never. It's like you want to get in on the conversation. So let's go back and talk a little bit more about kind of the stop data that we have collected. One of the things that is interesting is that the numbers are almost absolutely the same from 2004 and 2005, which like really surprised me, is that, you know, it's almost the same number of arrests. So, it doesn't appear to be, you know, any difference in whether you have more police officers or less police officers. The numbers seem to be kind of constant.
Yeah, and that seemed also including the actions that take place. There wasn't a whole lot of shifts between warnings and citations and custodies or no enforcement. I mean, it looks like, you know, just business as usual, I guess, is what you could say.
Right.
Which leaves the question then, you know, if this is, and I haven't gone back to look at 2002 and 2003.
Me either. I didn't pull out the old one.
Yeah, but the question then is, if this is the case, why are we still waiting before we take any sort of action? We could be launching some programs to try to deal with this, the Bureau could, and, you know, make course changes later.
Well, you know, I think about the $500,000 that was created to create a police accountability office inside the Portland Police Bureau, which is in the latest budget that came through. I'm thinking, well, wait, we're going to hire people to check to see that we're actually treating people with dignity and respect. Probably not having someone working in the police bureau would be a better way to do that kind of assessment. Then the other thing is, I'm still concerned about the $2 million that was proposed in the budget to be raised by targeting traffic infractions so that the police could make money off of towing automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's another way to target low-income people because it's not I mean, I have never met anybody who didn't want to be legally licensed or didn't want their car legally registered, but I've met many people who are making the choice, do I put food on my table or do I pay this parking fine?
Right.
Do I put food on the table or do I get auto insurance this month? And clearly, I'm concerned because if this data shows that we haven't gotten better with a new proposal to actually target poor people to raise revenue for the police bureau, that these numbers are going to get significantly worse by next year this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm hopeful that as we start having these community listening sessions, that it will become clear that targeting poor people to raise money for your general fund is not going to be the best approach for the police bureau to take.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, unfortunately, that strategy will exacerbate these numbers.
Probably so. You know, I was looking at the internal memo, too, that the chief sent out.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed that, you know, she signs herself as the chief as opposed to the acting chief, is where they refer to her in the paper. But
well, you know.
I
possession's 9/10 the law, you know.
It's true. She's got the office under her control. But, you know, down here in the footer is community policing, making the difference together. And that would suggest that we actually have a community policing program, which would be news to me.
Yeah. I think it's a stretch to assume that today we have anything resembling
mm-hmm.
community policing. But it is certainly my hope that we can start putting together a process whereby we can actually achieve community policing, right? Because the key to community policing is that the community has to be an equal partner at the table. And we don't have any tables right now that provide citizens an equal opportunity
right.
to interact with the police force. And so having these listening sessions at the end, my hope is that out of that, the recommendations are is that we create some more formal process whereby we continue to have this dialogue between the police and the community on a regular basis in public so that the community also gets to be educated about these issues at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I asked the chief yesterday, and she sort of gave a, not a flip answer, but a relatively short and not very satisfying answer, which is, I mean, one of the things it still seems to me is we got to get cops out of the cars. Now, yes, I know we need patrol cars
right.
to do 911 calls, but
right.
until you get officers walking the beat and interacting with people so they know who folks are.
Exactly.
I mean, regardless of what that officer's background is, it's going to be tougher and touger
right.
for he or her to, you know, perform in inappropriate manners when they're out there, you
That's
know,
right.
in the midst of the community.
And Chief Sizer, even the story she told yesterday, right, about when she was a rookie cop and she met Charles Maxey and another Charles, I forget the other Charles, but, you know, met community members, got connected with them, and she said she knew she was doing a good job when they told her she was doing a good job.
Exactly.
That was the way she checked herself against what the community wanted and what the community perceived as good policing practices.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, because she has that background, I'm much more hopeful that she will take that background and use it to actually help move forward this agenda. Because clearly, I mean, you know, we have to have the police.
Mm-hmm.
And the police cannot be effective at their job if they don't have community support.
Right.
And a community cannot support the police if they don't feel that they can trust that the police are being fair and equitable and how they're interacting with all the people in the community and
mm-hmm.
not just with a select few.
Mm-hmm.
I was out in Brentwood, Darlington last night, and I was somebody was telling me a story about, you know, they've got a substation right there by the community center, but they said when they call the police, it takes anywhere from half hour to 45 minutes for police to come because the police look at, oh, felony flats, oh, well, you know, we don't really have to rush to get there. And I said, well, do you think that you're entitled to less police services because you live in a low-income community, or do you believe that you have the same right to police coverage as any other part of the state, right? And, of
mm-hmm.
course, they said, well, we should have what the rest of the city has, right? Well, then the police needs to know that. They need to know that this community feels like when they call, they don't show up, right? And so it's important that that's on the record. I think we've got a caller.
I didn't know.
Good morning, caller. Welcome to Cable.
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
I am fabulous. Thank you. Excellent show as
Thank
usual.
You.
Good
Thank
job, you.
You
guys. I was just telling Richard that Thursday is like laundry day for me.
Uh-huh.
And so I want you to know I did 2 loads of grass while listening to cable.
All right, all right.
You guys are inspiring.
Could we drop our laundry off?
Yeah, right, right. If I'd have known Thursday was laundry day, hey.
Okay, listen, here's the deal. I'm retired now, but like, I was a chef and like kitchen worker.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, if I cut myself in the kitchen, or if I got burnt, and if I went to the doctor, I had to have my urine tested before I left the doctor's office.
Aha! Uh-huh, right.
All right. Now right. It's my understanding that the police department does not have to go through any drug testing at all.
That's correct.
Well, doesn't that seem a little weird to you guys?
Well, actually, you know, you raise a good question, because I remember Foxworth actually answering this question a couple of months ago, and I remembered him thinking out loud that he didn't think he had the authority to ask police officers to take a urine test. Well, and I remember thinking at the time when I read that, well, that's pretty bizarre. If you're the police chief and you can't ask your officers to take a urine test. But I never heard anything else about that.
I mean, we are talking about a group of people who actually have the responsibility of like people's lives.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
All right, and with steroids that police officers could possibly take, alcohol, maybe abusing other drugs, because I'm sure that they fit in exactly with the rest of the population. They have very, very stressful jobs.
Exactly.
And I'm sure that there has to be drug use, quote unquote, among police officers. Mm-hmm. And if the example is Kendra James was on the gun down in her car, right?
Right.
I'm sure that the police officer who shot her didn't have to go through any kind of drug testing.
Nope.
Well, it's a question probably what's in the collective bargaining agreement with the police union. Unions in general try to be opposed to just random drug
mm-hmm.
screens
mm-hmm.
because they do tend to become an abusive tool used by management. But
right.
clearly, yeah, as you say, these are unusual circumstances.
But you think about a bus driver that
right.
has a crash. What's the first thing you do with the bus driver? You give him a urine test, right?
Right.
You think about a taxi driver,
mm-hmm.
the exact
right.
same thing. So it's
a police
like
officer
like,
shoots somebody. They...
So you know, you would think that the standard would be higher
mm-hmm.
when you are sworn to serve and protect, and you have a gun on your side
oh,
that
agree.
You get to decide when you
right.
use it. So
yes.
you would think that yeah, there'd be. Hopefully, those are the kind of questions that will come out of these community listening sessions over the next 5 weeks. First one tonight at Brentwood Darlington Community Center. Which is located at 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Southeast Portland. And it's connected to the Southeast Precinct. So that's tonight. Next week it's going to be at the East Portland Community Center, and we'll be giving you the contact information for that. But, it's we're starting a process that I hope will, at the end, give us much better relationships and have true community policing. Thank you for your call. I'm so pleased that one of my favorite callers got to have the last word.
Oh, shucks, man. Well,
have a fabulous, fabulous day.
Thank you. Back at you.
And
thanks for the great show.
Thank you.
Thanks
appreciate that. And on that note, this is Joanne Bowman.
And this is Dave Mazza.
And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge, and it's been my pleasure to be here with you once again. And we'll see you next week. Same
All
time,
right.
same place, same channel.